Acts 2:1 through 2:13. The 12th talk in a series on the Book of Acts was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 19, 1998 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1998. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
We've been spending several weeks looking at the teaching on the spirit of truth, the parakletos in the Gospel of John and the early part of Acts. We now finally get to that day in Acts chapter 2. We finally get to that day that Jesus had predicted and that the disciples were waiting for, the disciples were anticipating, what we now know as the day of Pentecost. We'll look at first 12 verses, 13 verses of chapter 2. And when the day of Pentecost had come, they were all together in one place. And suddenly there came from heaven a noise like a violent rushing wind, and it filled the whole house where they were sitting. And there appeared to them tongues as of fire distributing themselves, and they rested on each one of them. And they were all filled with the Holy Spirit, and began to speak with other tongues, as the Spirit was giving them utterance. Now there were Jews living in Jerusalem, devout men from every nation under heaven. And when the sound occurred, the multitude came together and were bewildered, because they were each one hearing them speak in his own language. And they were amazed and marveled, saying, "Why are not all these who are speaking Galileans? Why are not all these who are speaking Galileans? And how is it that we each hear them in our own language, to which we were born? Parthians and Medes and Elamites, and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt, and the districts of Libya around Cyrene, and visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them in our own tongues speaking of the mighty deeds of God." And they continued in amazement and great perplexity, saying to one another, "What does this mean?" But others were mocking and saying, "They are full of sweet wine." The disciples have been waiting for roughly 50 days, even more than that. They've been waiting, and day by day they've been in this room, which, as we have learned in the past, was the same room that Jesus and the disciples had the Last Supper in. They've been hanging out in this room as per the instructions of Jesus. Jesus said, "Hang out here, wait until the Spirit comes upon you." They've been sitting in this room just waiting. I don't think this day was any different than any other day. They were in that same room, gathered together in one place. And as I suggested in the past, I think their routine was basically to try to sort out what's going on, what can we expect, what is God doing in the world, what is this thing that Jesus has told us to wait for. Probably studying the Old Testament scriptures, looking at the prophets and what the prophets said, trying to figure this stuff out. They're here to do the same thing on this day, but this happens to be a festival day. This is the day of Pentecost. Pentecost gets its name from being a festival that was, scheduled to be 50 days after a certain day in Passover. I don't remember which one. I have it here. The name comes from the fact that it's set by counting from the Sabbath of Passover to the day after the seventh Sabbath, 50 days after the Sabbath of Passover. Scholars don't really seem to know what Pentecost was celebrating. They think that it was an ancient harvest festival, the same as the Feast of First Fruits in the Old Testament. They believe that in the Old Testament that's what it was. But by the time we get to the New Testament, it appears to be, according to the rabbinic tradition, it appears to be a celebration of the giving of the law on Mount Sinai to Moses. In the Qumran literature, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they describe it as a celebration of the renewal of the covenant. that makes a certain amount of sense, actually. I mean, if that's what it is, then it occurs to me that what God is doing by having the Spirit be poured out on the day of Pentecost in the way that he did, is that he's indicating that this now is the new covenant. On the day that we celebrate the covenant, we are going to establish and set up a whole new covenant. Because the giving of the Spirit, as we, well, I don't know if we've talked about it in here, but if you look at Jeremiah 31 and other references to the New Testament, to the New Covenant, the Spirit of God is associated with the New Covenant. As Jeremiah puts it, there are really two things that make the New Covenant. One is that the sins will be forgiven once and for all, never to be remembered anymore. And the New Testament emphasizes how that's on the basis of Jesus' death, his willingness to give up his life. On that basis, our sins will be remembered no more. But secondly, that the sins are going to be remembered no more to people upon whom the law of God, upon whom, whose hearts the law of God has been inscribed. And that, the New Testament knows, is the activity of the Spirit of God. So I'm to a certain extent speculating here, but this seems like a reasonable speculation, that God was waiting for Pentecost because God is wanting to send the message. The Spirit of God coming into the world is a new covenant that God is establishing with the nations. So anyway, they're here as they had been for days upon days, not knowing exactly what they're waiting for, doing whatever they have normally been doing on the day of Pentecost. And all of a sudden, there came from heaven, he says, a noise like a violent rushing wind. I think the description from heaven is probably Luke's comment on the source of this noise. I don't think he's speaking phenomenologically that the noise sounded like it was coming from heaven. I'm not sure what a sound would sound like if it sounded like it was coming from heaven. I think Luke is simply commenting that this was a supernatural noise. There was no natural explanation for the noise that they heard. So this supernatural noise happened, a violent rushing wind that filled the whole house where they were sitting. And I've already commented, the house they were sitting was this upper room where they had celebrated the Passover several weeks earlier. This is not, interestingly, in looking at this passage carefully, it corrects my image of Pentecost. For some reason, my mental image of Pentecost was that we were out in the huge, vast courtroom of the temple, and crowds and crowds and crowds of people were gathered there, and all of a sudden, this event happened that all of Jerusalem noticed and all of Jerusalem observed. That doesn't really seem to be the description. We have about roughly 120 people in this room, and then this noise happens. The noise is heard more broadly, and people from all over the city are drawn to this room to see what's happening because they hear this bizarre noise that they cannot account for. So he calls it a multitude that gathers. But they are gathered to this spot rather than already being in one spot when this thing occurs. They're brought to it out of curiosity. Is there any significance to this noise like a violent rushing wind? Again, I think so. In Ezekiel 37, that's the passage, I believe, about the Valley of Dry Bones. If you remember that, that's the Negro spiritual is based on Ezekiel 37. You've got this valley of dry bones, and something happens, God speaks or something, and the bones grow flesh and become, out of skeletons, they become actual corpses, but they are not alive. They're just dead corpses there. And then either God speaks or Ezekiel speaks or something, and there's this mighty, I think it's God sends angels to the four corners of the world to call on the winds, and the winds come rushing down into the valley, and as the winds rush down the valley, the corpses come to life. And it seems to be in Ezekiel 37 to be a description of something that still has to happen in our future that has never happened yet. It's a picture, a metaphor of the spiritual rejuvenation of the people of God, of Israel. That he seems to be describing that in history, you've got this, the nation that is spiritually desolate, spiritually completely, utterly dead, so dead, so thoroughly dead that they are like dry skeletons, not a flesh on their bones. And the first step is that God is going to put flesh on their bones, but they will not be alive yet, but they will have the semblance of life about them. But then, at a later event, God is going to call on the winds to blow into this people and blow life into them and to instill them with life. What appears to be describing is Israel will, and perhaps they already have, you know, perhaps we're looking at a nation that has flesh on its bones now. It is a nation with a national identity in the promised land and so on. I don't know. Maybe they're not lifelike enough yet. I'm not sure how to interpret that. But there's going to come a point where the nation of Israel, it is as if they have life, but they don't really, because they have no spiritual life. But then the time is going to come when, and here I think the winds can only be a description of the activity of the Spirit of God himself. The Spirit of God is going to impart life to them. And when the Spirit of God imparts life to them, then they will truly be the people of God, and God, they will be the people of God, and God will be their God. That's going to happen one day as they become genuinely spiritually revived by the Spirit of God, the wind. That, I think, is the significance of the wind here, because that's exactly what's happening to these people in this room, is the Spirit of God is giving them spiritual vitality, spiritual life, eyes to see, ears to hear, a heart that longs for God. Something that they have not had before, something that they have never experienced. And that is happening at this very time among these 120 people in this room. The wind being a symbol of that, I believe. You probably know that in both Greek and in Hebrew, the word for wind and the breath and spirit are, depending upon what language we're talking about, either identical or there are synonyms that are used. The word that's used here is virtually synonymous with the word that's used for breath. And the word for breath is identical with the word used for spirit. Okay, so the wind is one of the phenomena. The other phenomena are these tongues of fire. Now, don't be confused. They're about to speak in tongues, but the tongues of fire simply, I think, he's using tongues the way that we would use tongues, as in the tongue of a shoe or a tongue of land out into the ocean, but just a little pointy thing. In other words, he's trying to describe metaphorically a flame. So you've got this little campfire girl bonfire over each and every one of their heads. You know, a really bizarre thing, you know, bizarre image. But that's the other phenomenon here. But why? What's going on? You can't help but you can't help but be reminded of the comment that John the Baptist made when he said, "One is coming who will baptize with the Spirit and with fire." Now, don't misunderstand me. I don't think that John was merely predicting what was going to happen on the day of Pentecost. I think it's far more profound than that. What John meant is, one is coming who is going to baptize you one way or the other. He's going to be the person in human history with whom you have to do. You have to make a decision. What are you going to do with Jesus? You're either going to be his disciple, which is to be baptized with the Spirit, in effect. That is, you're either going to be chosen by God and given the Spirit that qualifies you for life, or you're going to be baptized with eternal condemnation, one or the other, the fire representing judgment and condemnation. But you're going to be baptized one way or the other. it just seems to me that this image here of having the fire dancing over your head is an image of a group of people who, although they deserve and are worthy of being baptized with fire, if you will, although they stand under the judgment of God, they stand under condemnation rightly, nonetheless, because the wind of the Spirit is instilling life in them, is qualifying them for life, they therefore will escape the judgment, will escape the fire. Although they stand under the fire, they are not going to be consumed by the fire. They're not going to experience judgment. Basically, what I'm saying here, it's too bad Wes isn't here, what I'm saying here is that God is doing performance art. He's using symbolic, metaphorical, material, physical realities that he is supernaturally producing here to create an image of profound and important truths that he wants these people to understand and recognize. And the image that God has created here with the fire dancing over their heads is exactly what Lon is trying to capture in the title of his book, Righteous Sinners. We are both sinners who, in and of ourselves, given our nature, our moral nature, are worthy of condemnation. The fire belongs there when we belong under the fire. But nevertheless, by the provision of God, the good news is that we are going to escape that condemnation and escape that judgment because of this other reality that has been brought into existence by the Spirit of God working within us. The Spirit of God has given us a heart and a spirit that is right, that is righteous in some significant sense, and it marks us as people who are not going to be under the judgment, although we deserve it. He then goes on to say, the other thing that happened is they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other tongues as the Spirit was giving them utterance. I think it's important that we not miss the significance of as the Spirit was giving them utterance. I think in the past I've just assumed that all he was saying there is they did not have the ability to speak in whatever the language of Crete was, or whatever the language of Cappadocia was, or Phrygia, or Egypt. They weren't able to speak those languages, but the Spirit of God was giving them intelligible sentences in those languages to speak. And they were kind of supernaturally saying something that they didn't understand. And that's the sense in which the Spirit was giving them utterances. But I think instead, in keeping with what the function of the Spirit is, namely, the function of the Spirit is to bring us enlightenment, to give us an understanding, to give us the ability to grasp what it is that's right and good and true and going on in the world. That's what these people have been spending, that's what these 120 people have been spending the last several days doing, is seeking, groping in the dark without enlightenment, looking at the prophets, looking at the Old Testament scriptures, trying to figure this stuff out, trying to understand what's going on. All of a sudden on this day, the lights go on. And probably not independently of the study that they have been doing. I mean, all this study that they have been doing has been, you know, storing information and ideas and concepts in their head. But on this day, it clicked. And one by one after another, they stood up, and as he describes it later, verse 11, we hear them in our own tongues speaking of the mighty deeds of God. What does that mean? I think what it means is the Spirit was giving them utterance in the sense that all of a sudden they understood what the events, what the prophecies, what the psalms, the poetry in the Old Testament, it clicked. What all that stuff meant. And one by one, they would think of a psalm, or they'd think of something that a prophet said, or they would remember an incident in the history of Israel, and they were able to stand up and say, I understand. Don't you see what the prophet Isaiah was saying here? And here's what the prophet Jeremiah was saying here. And you remember when God did this, said this to Moses, as he did this in the nation of Israel here? All of a sudden, they were able to connect what all of the stuff from the Old Testament was saying with what they had learned from Jesus and what they were seeing about what God is doing and had done in sending his son Jesus. All of a sudden it clicked. That's the Spirit giving them utterance, I think. In other words, the Spirit was giving them understanding. The Spirit was giving them insight. The Spirit was enlightening their minds. And out of that new enlightenment that had come upon them, they were speaking and declaring the truth. But this weird thing happened. What happened is they would stand up to say something, and instead of out of their mouth coming what it, the point that they were intending to make, all of a sudden were coming syllables and sounds and noises that were foreign to them, that were alien to them, the speaker. But although it was alien to them, the speaker, it was not at all alien to some of the people gathered in the multitudes about them. They were saying in the language of that person over there the very thing that they had set out to say, I would argue. Now, I know that that's not a common and popular view of what speaking in tongues is all about, but I'm convinced that that's the only way to understand Acts 2, and it's the only way to understand 1 Corinthians 14, where Paul is describing what tongues is all about. Let me see if I can articulate this better. There's a documented There's a documented disorder where a particular part of your brain has the function of taking whatever verbal meaning you are intending to say and that you are seeking to articulate. It takes it and translates it into the sounds that you make with your mouth. This disorder affects only that part of speech, only that part of speech that takes the ideas, the concepts, the intention, the verbal intention, and translates it into sounds, and it misfires. And instead of the English that you know so well and can speak coming out, what comes out is gibberish. What comes out is just complete and total nonsense. And I knew somebody who knew somebody with this disorder, and he said that he'd be talking along normally, and then all of a sudden, just garbled stuff would come out. He would not immediately realize that garbled stuff was coming out until he began to hear himself, and then he'd have to stop. Then he'd have to start all over again and see if he could get it right this time. And depending upon, I don't know what triggered it, but depending upon what was going on, he would have more or less trouble with that. The thing that's significant about that is that it indicates, now, the point that's crucial to understand is he's not intending to speak gibberish. He knows exactly how he wanted his sentence to end. It's just that his mouth didn't say what his head was trying to say. What his head wanted to say, his mouth wasn't saying. And that the point being, there's a different mental function that formulates my verbal intent from the mental function that produces the sounds that represent that in language. Those are two different mental functions. That's why Paul says, I think, in 1 Corinthians 14, he says, when you pray in a tongue, the spirit prays, but the mind is unfruitful, he says in verse 12. I think what he means by that is the spirit representing that ultimate core of consciousness, it's praying. I mean, it's seeking to address God in a meaningful way, knowing precisely what it wants to say, knowing precisely what it intends to say. But although the spirit is praying well enough, the verbal intention is there, the mind that translates that verbal intention into language is not producing anything meaningful to the people around. That, I think, is what's happening in Acts 2. The people are standing up and they're seeking to make a point that they are very well aware of and conscious of and intending to communicate in their native language, or in Hebrew or Aramaic or whatever it is they speak in. That's what they are intending to do. But what happens is it comes out in an entirely different language from the one that they know naturally, that they have acquired naturally. And it's miraculous in that the language that it comes out in is no language that they have any familiarity with. They could never speak that language if they tried to in a million years. But all of a sudden, God intervenes and takes over that function in the brain, which takes what you want to say and translates it into language. God intervenes, takes over that function of the brain, and makes the very ideas that they want to communicate come out in a different language than the language that they know. That, I think, is speaking in tongues on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2. That I don't think that that was a... all of this stuff that's going on here, the speaking in tongues, the flames of fire, and so on, none of those things are intended by God to be a permanent feature of the coming of the Spirit of God into the world. It's just, as I said, divine performance art on this particular occasion. But there is something that was intended to be permanent. There's something that is permanently and radically changing in the world on this day. On this day, the Spirit of God has gone abroad in the world to open the eyes and open the ears of people, enlighten them so that they understand on a scale that the human race has never understood God before. And that is beginning on the day of Pentecost. Okay. Let me just make one other point from this passage. You might, just so you get the picture here, most of you probably know this, but you know, what is going on that we have all these people from all over the Roman Empire who speak all kinds of different languages? Why are they all here in Jerusalem on this day? There's this thing called the diaspora, or the dispersion, that through the course of the history of Israel, Israel has been beat up on and captured and invaded and taken captive and enslaved and shipped literally all over the world at various times in their history. So by the time you get to the New Testament, you have people who remarkably have maintained their identity as Jews, have maintained their religion as Jews, and yet have been assimilated at the same time, have been assimilated into vastly different cultures all over the known world at that time. But because they are Jews who identify with Jews, they still see it as their divinely ordained responsibility to keep the festivals. So you have in the rabbinical tradition, the rabbis try to soften what the Old Testament says. The Old Testament, for example, says on Passover, every male Jew goes to Jerusalem and must go to Jerusalem and must celebrate Passover in the city of Jerusalem, every year. That's what the Old Testament says. But that recognized the Jews as living within traveling distance of Jerusalem. So the rabbis interpret that as they're thinking of, what about a Jew in Spain? Every year take a trip to Jerusalem and there are no flights? You know, just we're talking about a major investment of a person's life to take a several-month boat trip from Spain to Jerusalem every year. They realized what a hardship that was and interpreted that it was sufficient that at least once in their lifetime they would take a trip to Jerusalem and celebrate Passover in Jerusalem once in their lifetime. So they softened it, but nonetheless, it was a given that year after year after year, there would be a flood of pilgrims who would come into Jerusalem to celebrate Passover and keep the other festivals. That's what has happened here. We're 50 days after Passover, about to celebrate another Jewish festival, and we have Jews from all over the Roman Empire, from all over the known world of that time, who are practicing Jews, but they have lived and grown up in other cultures, speaking other languages. If they may not even speak Aramaic at all. They probably, certainly don't speak Hebrew. They speak Greek, or Latin, perhaps, because those were the two universal languages. They speak either Greek or Latin, but they don't speak Hebrew, and they don't speak Aramaic. Here are these Galileans whose native language is Aramaic, and all of a sudden they're speaking the language of their homeland back in Spain or Northern Africa or up in what we now know of as Turkey or down in Ethiopia or whatever. And they go, whoa, this is amazing. But notice the unbelief in this passage in verse 12 and 13. Two forms of unbelief. And they continued in amazement and great perplexity, saying to one another, "What does this mean?" I'm speculating, but after Peter responds, many of them got their explanation. Many of them then understood what this all meant when Peter explained it to them. But there were many who undoubtedly did not accept Peter's explanation, did not get it, and probably walked away still saying, "What does this mean?" That one form of unbelief is just this perpetual uncertainty, this perpetual confusion, this perpetual inability to land and come to any sort of commitment about who God is and what he's up to and what's going on by the hand of God. We just won't know. We refuse to know. We refuse to decide what the truth is. But notice we have a more hostile reaction here too in verse 13. "But others were mocking and saying, 'They are full of sweet wine.'" You see this over and over in the Bible. You see it in your own, among your own neighbors and friends. I mean, what an absurd suggestion. Granted, other people speaking in other languages, I suppose, if you don't pay a whole lot of attention, I suppose you could think that they're just jabbering nonsensical syllables. Although you really don't have to be all that hip to recognize a language as different from gibberish. I mean, even if you don't know the language, you can sort of feel the rhythm and the structure of sounds that are a language as distinct from just complete nonsense syllables. They really don't sound the same. But let's grant them that that it was so foreign, languages were so foreign to them that they're just saying, "Oh, they're speaking gibberish. Why are they speaking gibberish? They're drunk." But we have a situation here where they're discussing among one another, "Whoa, they're speaking Cretan. Wow, they're speaking, you know, whatever this language is, whatever that language is." People are observing, not among the 120, but among the multitude on the outside. They're discussing with one another what's going on, that they're able to, how do they know this language? The evidence is there that something very remarkable, very wonderful is happening here. And yet, what is their response? "They're just drunk." It reminds me of the rationalization of the Pharisees after Jesus healed the, what was it, deaf or blind person who was deaf or blind because of a demon. He cast out the demon and healed the person. And the Pharisees wonder among themselves, "Well, how can he do that?" "Oh, I know, it's by the prince of demons. It's by Beelzebul that he can do that." And Jesus proceeds to suggest that that's a rather stupid argument. That's a rather stupid explanation. But why are we willing to settle for stupid explanations? Because we don't want to believe the truth. Whatever I'm going to believe, I'm not going to believe that this is the Messiah sent from God. Or in this case, whatever I'm going to believe, I'm not going to believe that this is an authentic act of God himself reaching down into history and doing something remarkable. I'd rather believe that these people are drunk than that God is at work. That's the spirit of unbelief. That's the essence of unbelief that we, at all costs, refuse to face into the truth and will believe any weird rationalization over the truth itself. Okay. Questions, comments? Please wait for the mic.
In the area where you were talking about how they started speaking and in tongues at the very beginning, you were making the argument that they were suddenly speaking stuff that they hadn't understood before. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit. Maybe I missed it or drifted off or something, but I missed what your reasons were. Were there any reasons specifically from the text that led you to that conclusion, or was it sort of a broader picture that you're drawing that conclusion from?
Specifically, why it was stuff that they had not already understood, meaning?
Yes.
Well, simply because he says in 2:4, as the Spirit was giving them utterance, I wouldn't, the crucial piece is not whether they had understood it before. but whether what they were understanding was the result of the activity of the Spirit of God. It just seems to me that what Luke seems to be saying here is, here is the coming of the Spirit happening now, as Jesus had promised and as Jesus had predicted. Here the Spirit of truth is coming into the world. And what was going to be the function of the Spirit of truth in the case of the disciples? To bring to remembrance all that Jesus had taught them. And as we looked at that and as I interpreted that, I think he means more than just kind of surface casual memory, but rather real grasp of the meaning of what it was that Jesus had taught them, that they're really getting it now. And so for Luke to comment as the Spirit was giving them utterance, strikes me that the point he's trying to communicate is, just as Jesus had predicted the Spirit would do, the Spirit of truth would do, he would come and all of a sudden help them see, help them grasp it, help them understand it, that that's what's going on here. That the light is going on because the Spirit of truth is shining his light on the stuff that they've been studying, thinking about, remembering, discussing with one another. The Spirit of truth is shining his light on that, and now all of a sudden what they see, they speak. What they understand, they proclaim. My textual evidence for that is the Spirit was giving them utterance. I'm just trying to understand, what does Luke have in mind when he says the Spirit was giving them utterance?
Well, maybe one of the reasons why I asked is because, I mean, a large part of this section is about the show, in some sense, the performance that you were talking about, as somehow this being a big show that everybody gets everybody's attention, that brings them in so that suddenly Peter can explain what's going on, that sort of thing. And I guess I was wondering why, you know, giving them utterance can simply mean because the Spirit suddenly gave them the ability to speak, which provided the show along with the flames and all that sort of thing. Am I clear as to what I'm saying or not?
Yeah. Well, that's what I've always assumed that it meant, was that the Spirit giving them utterance was the supernatural ability to speak in the other language. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
That's what I've always assumed. That's not impossible, but the point to recognize is that there's both content to what they're saying. See, it's not like they're standing up and just saying, making announcements in another language, or the content of what they're saying. They're hearing them talk about the mighty deeds of God, speaking of the mighty deeds of God. There's real content to what they're saying. And I think we're accustomed to thinking that they have just turned into inert speaking machines, and that they're really not the ones speaking, but rather it's the Spirit of God, you know, I guess like some weird horror film where a demon or some alien takes over your body and uses your mouth because it doesn't have one. But it's using your mouth to say what it wants to say. And the content of what's being said is not coming out of the identity of the person speaking. You're just a body being used by some alien force. I think that's probably the way I've always assumed we are to interpret Pentecost, is all of a sudden the Spirit takes over their bodies and speaks through their vocal cords. But I don't see any reason to interpret it that way. It makes more sense to me that when Peter speaks in Cretan or whatever he speaks in, Peter's saying what Peter wants to say, but it's coming out in a language that's unnatural for him. Once I see it that way, then I have to ask myself the question, and what is he saying, and why is he saying, and how does he know to say it? Well, I think that's what Luke is trying to capture. It's because the Spirit is giving him utterance. He now gets it. He now understands. He now sees what he has only partially seen in the past. And now he can boldly and with courage, out of the courage that comes from conviction and out of the conviction that comes from confidence, he can stand up and say, this is what's going on. This is the truth. This is the way it is. This is what God is doing in the world. That makes more sense to me as to what Luke is trying to capture as the Spirit was giving them utterance. Because the point he's making is they were speaking in other tongues as the Spirit was giving them utterance. And there's two ways to look at that. Either either that's one and the same thing, the Spirit is giving them the other tongues to say, or what he's saying is, as the Spirit was giving them the content to say, as he enlightened their minds, there was this other thing happening where God was short-circuiting that normal process and supernaturally articulating sounds corresponding to that content in another language. That's what makes more sense to me.
Can I keep going? I hope you guys don't mind. Well, if that were the case, and that certainly is a possibility, it certainly makes sense as a possibility. I guess the reason why I'm a little hesitant or continuing to pursue this is because one would expect that maybe that there would be some other clue in the text that would suggest that the content, that they somehow now have a more substantial understanding because of the Spirit, that there would be something in there that would point to that. There would be some other statement in there or passage in there that would say, this is an important thing that's going on in this passage that we should realize, that they suddenly now have more understanding or get it better than they did before. And maybe I just don't seem to see that in the rest of the passage. And what seems to be the focus of it is that suddenly there's this big show that's going on, and there doesn't seem to be much focus on the fact that somehow they have a more clear understanding. I mean, I agree with you. It seems clear that, or very likely that they're not speaking stuff that they don't understand what they're talking about. They are probably speaking stuff that they know from themselves and what they've learned from Jesus, just that they're speaking in a different language. What I'm questioning is whether or not we should take it that step further, that somehow they understand better.
Well, we'll talk about this probably next week, but immediately what Peter goes on to say, and this is a big piece of information for me, a big piece of evidence for me, is he quotes Joel, where he says, "And it shall be in the last days, God says, that I will pour forth of my Spirit upon all mankind, all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. Even upon my bond slaves, both men and women, I will in those days pour forth my Spirit, and they shall prophesy." As I will suggest when we look at that next week and look at Joel, that I think what he's talking about is there's going to come a time when every person from the least to the greatest, even the bond servants, are going to have the Spirit poured out, and what's going to be the result? They will prophesy. And I think what he means by that is that he's seeing what's happening in that upper room as corresponding to what that text is describing. What is the most remarkable thing for him? Not the fact that they're speaking in other languages, because that's not even mentioned by Joel. The most remarkable thing is, here are these people who haven't had a clue, who are all of a sudden in a position to prophesy, that is, to speak forth the mighty deeds of God. Why? Because the Spirit has been poured forth. That he seems to connect that prophecy and the ability to understand, the ability to have revealed to you by God, just as if you were a prophet, to have revealed to you by God what it is that we need to know, the truth that we need to know. And that's the connection he makes. So that was one of the things that started me thinking, wow, he's not as impressed with the speaking of their language as he is in the fact that these people are prophesying, are speaking and speaking truly about the mighty deeds of God.
Okay, thanks. I'll wait for next week.
Okay.
Oh, any other question?
Okay.
Sure. In verse 12, it talks about what does it say? Think about
very perplexity, saying to one another, "What does this mean?"
Yeah, what does this mean? You're not saying that having a questioning attitude is unbelief.
No, but I'm saying refusing to ever hear any answers is unbelief. That I was in Israel once with Dr. Walkey, who's an Old Testament professor, and one of the things that we were doing as part of our tour is we have a morning Bible study together. And our Bible study was to go through the different words for fool in the Proverbs, because there's different Hebrew words that are translated fool. And one of the words, he said, that the sense seems to be the sort of person, a person who's open-minded. And what he means by open-minded is not typically what we mean by open-minded, as, you know, being willing to be persuaded and being open to evidence and so on. But the kind of person whose open-mindedness consists of never closing your mind around anything. That is, you always remain open to all possibilities. Why? Because you're never going to accept anything as the truth. You're never going to accept anything as real, as something to ground your life and belief on. It's actually an intellectual pathology to be that open-minded. But yet you meet people like that, who just, all of life is just a smorgasbord of different ideas and concepts and philosophies and religions, and you're there to kind of experience them all and enjoy them all. None of them are true, but all of them are wonderful. Well, that's an intellectual pathology. The fact of the matter is, there is truth and there is error, and I ought to be on a quest for truth. In that quest, I need to be open-minded in the sense that I'm open to being persuaded that one way is true over against another, and not just kind of dogmatically and irrationally and be so emotionally secure in a certain position that my attitude is kind of damn the truth full speed ahead. That's wrong. But to come to a point of confidence and conviction and security and courage that grows out of, I've looked, I've seen, I've tasted, and this is true, and the other stuff is wrong, is false, is not a bad place to be. It's a good place to be. That's the way our minds were made to work, is to seek until we find, and then once found, own it as my own and embrace it as my own. Great, head.
Question about your example in Corinthians, where they talk about the improvements of mind. And it seemed to me, I'm thinking about it, and I'm going to kind of ask a question and explain my thoughts. Is that in Corinthians, that in Pentecost you have fruit of mind.
Right.
Because some of the Corinthians, so in Corinthians you have unfruit of mind. And it seems that it was possible that some people that were at Pentecost wanted to, saw the stuff, they got some of it, they didn't get all of it, they saw the show part, and got maybe some confusion, went back to Corinthians, started the church. They're trying to mimic the spiritualism or something they saw, they got some truth, they got some falsehood, so they're trying to promote this speaking in tongues thing, which to them probably appeared to be different. And that, so just correct me if I'm thinking in the wrong direction, but that, so they were actually unfruitful because they weren't communicating or instructing me, but elucidating the truths. They were just making it material.
Right.
That's what's false.
Yeah, exactly. I'm convinced that what's happening in Corinth is the speaking in tongues that is going on in Corinth is very, very similar to the speaking in tongues that is going on in our culture today in certain churches and denominations and certain aspects of the Christian culture. It's a normal psychological phenomenon. I mean, if it's true that there is this mechanism, this faculty of the human mind that just forms syllables, then it's entirely possible, I think, for something to happen to trigger that function, that faculty of the mind to operate completely independent of any verbal intention, of any operation of the mind to actually say something. And one could probably quite fluidly produce syllables, but they're just meaningless. I mean, they don't have any content to them at all. Now, I don't know what would induce that state, what would trigger that mind to do that, but I don't think it's demons. I don't think it's evil. I don't think we gain anything by saying that's all of Satan. But I do think we need to recognize that it's just a normal part of human psychology. And what bears that out is glossolalia is a phenomenon that you know in every religion about the world. All over the world, people speak in glossolalia in certain circumstances, and they tend to associate it as a religious experience or a form of spirituality or something because it is such an unusual and not, you know, not an out of the ordinary kind of experience. Well, I think that's what's going on in our culture today, and I think that's exactly what was going on in Corinth. And if you look at Paul's discussion in Corinth carefully, Paul is being very diplomatic. That is, I don't think he has enough first-hand experience of what's going on there to be able to judge once and for all and conclusively, you know, what's going on there is not authentic speaking in tongues. But reading between the lines, it sure looks like he suspects that that's the case, that what's going on there is not speaking in tongues like happened on the day of Pentecost at all. So his approach in 1 Corinthians is to try to say, okay, here's what tongues is, here's when and how it makes sense, so if anything that you're doing is different from this, then be quiet. Don't do this thing that you're doing if it doesn't fit into these parameters. And so he's creating these parameters that I think only leave room for the authentic working of the Spirit to induce speaking in other languages to be able to move, to have room to move. And yet it's not leaving room to move for this other experience, this natural psychological experience to happen. And one of the things, there's two things that he mentions. One is, two or three times he's insisting that unlike what you guys seem to be describing to me, where an alien being, the Spirit of God, takes over and you are doing this thing out of control, he insists that that's not speaking in tongues. The spirit of the prophet is subject to the prophet, he insists in 1 Corinthians 14. That is, in the speaking of tongues, I know exactly what I'm saying. I say it when I want to say it, the way I want to say it. It's just that it comes out in a different language. But it's not like I'm invaded by some foreign being who takes over my body and starts speaking to me. So that's not what's going on when I speak in tongues. So that's one big difference that he plays up. And then the other one is, what's the other one? Well, He can't make any sense out of, you know, he doesn't come down as hard as he might, but basically he says, it doesn't make any sense to me that the Spirit of God would come into your midst and make you speak in a language that nobody in the room understands. What's the point of that? And he hammers that point home, you know, over most of a chapter. He's saying, the whole point of communication is to communicate with somebody. If there's no communication going on, what's the point of that? I'd rather prophesy in, what's he say, in one word than 10,000 words, five words, than 10,000 words in a tongue that nobody understands. And there's no point in verbalizing just for the sake of verbalizing. And I think what he suspects is there's no real communication going on anyway because it's just gibberish. But they are claiming that these are other languages, and he's in no position to refute that. So he says, okay, well, then answer me this. Why? is this the God that we know who is not a God of confusion? Is this the God that we know who is coming into your midst and have you speak in a language that makes no sense to anybody and communicates with nobody? And we're actually spending time at this? What's the point? So, yes, he sees what they're doing as being unfruitful, unlike Pentecost, which is fruitful precisely because there's a whole group of people who understands everything that everybody is saying at the day of Pentecost.
You have described the miracle of communication that took place here as being one that took place in the tongue of the speaker. But in verse 8, it sounds like that maybe the miracle took place in the ear of the hearer. Can you explain what your view of that is?
Well, it's true that 8 says, and how is it that we each hear in our own language? But earlier he says, and when this sound occurred, verse 4, and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other tongues or other languages. So it's true that both 8 and 6 talk about them hearing them in other languages, but he's already said that the reason they're hearing them in other languages is because they're speaking in other languages as the Spirit came upon them. So I think that's why they're hearing the other languages, is because it's being spoken that way. Did you want to come back at that? Or?
Well, eight sounds like that. There may be a hearer from Ethiopia, a hearer from Spain, and the speaker would be heard by both of those people in their language. It says every man in his own tongue. Mm-hmm. Do you understand it that way?
No.
No, what I understand him to be saying is, it's not that every hearer understands every speaker, but rather that somewhere during the course of the overall event, somebody will stand up speaking in their language and then they understand it. The guy next to him from Spain may not understand what that person is saying, but he turns to him and saying, he's speaking my language. And so as they share information back and forth, they realize that during the course of this event, all these different languages are being spoken, and the people whose language it is understand them, and they're beginning to compare notes and realize, well, this is bizarre, because everyone doing the speaking is a Galilean who doesn't know any of our languages. That's how I'm understanding it. Larry, and then we'll go back. Two more, and then we better stop.
Simple question. The day that is used throughout this passage, the 120 or the 12?
Well, I think it's the 120. I don't know if there's any way to be certain about that, but I'm assuming it's the 120. Because otherwise, I think he would have distinguished them.
Yeah.
Okay. In that regard, I think it has to be the 120, because as we go on in Acts, this is going to happen again. This stuff is going to happen a couple of times to Gentiles and Samaritans and stuff like that, and that becomes very, very significant to the apostles, because they take that as kind of an absolute statement by God, I am doing the same thing in Samaritans and Gentiles that I have done among the Jews. So this is not just for Jews. And the one thing that makes them certain that that's the case is they think God has spoken in that regard by giving them their own little Pentecost experience. So that if it had just been the 12, well, I mean, I suppose that could still be true if it were the 12, but it's the fact that everybody who became believing, part of the believing community on Pentecost, had this experience, I think, is what makes them see this as the sign of the pouring out of the Spirit on the believing community. It's not just making them apostles or something, it's making them a part of these people who, from the least to the greatest, can prophesy.